couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Paws of Fury, The Legend of Hank, Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris, Love Accidentally, Resident Evil, and Solar Opposites Season 3. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring a look back at Electric Dreams. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news, it's a look back at Thor, and that there was this weird backlash that happened, especially for a movie that did so well. I think a lot of it goes down to the fact that Taika Waititi is not for everybody. I mean, he certainly is a popular director, but I think what happens with Taika Waititi's stuff is that if you don't like his stuff, you really don't like his stuff. And you saw that with Thor. I mean, we're not talking about a significantly low score. I mean, it's on the lower end of Marvel movies, but usually those Marvel movies are in the 90 percentile. It's on par with, you know, Iron Man 3, for example. But we have to acknowledge the fact that people can disagree about movies and still be friends. That's the great thing about movies. It's all about taste. Look, you can find movies that are objectively terrible. Battlefield Earth, for example, is an objectively terrible movie. Yet there are people out there who like that movie. Not a lot, but there are people that like it. No, find any movie, every single movie, no matter how bad it is, has people that like it, that genuinely like it. Especially if you let something sort of simmer in pop culture long enough, you will get a cult following for almost anything. And that's the joy of movies, is that everybody can like them on their own level. People don't have to agree with you. Now, I think some of this is pushed back because there is a section of the critical masses out there that did not like Thor. When there's a movie that gets lower critical ratings than expected, I've been noticing in recent years, you get a lot of critics going, oh, people didn't listen to us. They went and saw the movie anyways. And I'm like, that's the way it's always been. High critical scores have never 100% correlated with box office. I mean, the Transformers movies prove that. The Twilight movies prove that. Those are some really low-rated films, but they do very, very well. Don't worry, in a couple months, there's going to be a whole slate of award films that critics are going to go crazy over that nobody's going to care about. The low critical score on Eternals sort of lit a fire under some critics thinking, oh, well, people listened to us and said, oh, Eternals is terrible. And it didn't do as well as other Marvel movies. So look at the power we have. I just review movies and tell you what I think and be damned whether or not you agree with me. Now, there's been some discussion about the visual effects of Thor. Not necessarily the quality, although some people have talked about that. I don't have a problem with it because you know that everything in that movie is going to be digital. So it's easy to point out, oh, that looks like crap. Well, it's easy to point at something and say it looks like crap. But what's interesting is apparently there was this guy who worked on Thor and he took to Twitter talking about how bad the conditions were working with it and how, the deadlines were terrible and they kept changing things at the last minute. And here's my issue with it. As much as everybody said, well, Marvel should know better. They should make those decisions earlier. And how dare Marvel, with all the money they spend, treat those visual effects people that poorly? And look, I'm not saying that they're being treated well. But this is how the business worked, and it's always worked like that. To paraphrase George Lucas, he said, you never finish a movie, but you abandon it. Every movie, especially the big blockbusters with lots of visual effects, they're constantly tweaking and changing things. And a lot of times it's not even something that looks like a visual effect. I remember listening to the commentary on the Godzilla movie that Roland Emmerich did back in the 90s. All these little things that they had to fix in post-production that you didn't even realize were visual effects. Like in one scene, one of the actors looks at a identification badge and they had to either change the date or erase something on there digitally. That's something you never noticed. A lot of visual effects are that kind of work of them fixing something that you don't even realize is a visual effect. But I really blame the subcontracting companies for this, not necessarily Marvel. You should know what you're getting into when a major studio does this. But the subcontracting companies don't get behind their people. They're not protecting their workers. And the reason for that is it costs more money to pay visual effects artists in America. And Marvel could easily go outsource this to wherever, South Korea or India or somewhere like that, where you have people working for a lot less money. So yeah, is there a problem in the industry with this? Sure. Is it Marvel's fault? This is the way they've always done visual effects in movies. Now, Thor did very well. It did $144 million last week, which is huge. And that's great considering the week after 4th of July tends to be a little soft. And then, of course, Top Gun made a lot of news because, oh, broke $600 million domestic. It topped Titanic. Yes and no. I mean, it's great for the movie. I don't want to take anything away from Top Gun. It did very, very well, and it's a big juggernaut this summer. $600 million now is not even the same as $600 million 10 years ago. This is closer to the ticket sales in Top Gun to what Captain Marvel did in 2019, which was very, very good. It's nowhere near the number of tickets Titanic sold in 1997, which was 25 years ago. And it's a far, far, far cry from the likes of Star Wars or The Sound of Music or Gone with the Wind or anything like that. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first trailer I want to talk about is Luck, which is coming to theaters and Apple TV Plus on August 5th.
I blame bad luck for everything that's gone wrong in my life.
Until
I found an actual lucky penny. And what did I do? I flushed it down the toilet.
You flushed my penny down the toilet!
You just talked. Wait! I just need another penny!
Ah, humans cannot be here!
Where's here?
The land of luck.
I'll leave as soon as you give me another lucky penny.
This looks cute. With Apple coming off of the Oscar win for its streaming film Coda, it's legitimized these at-home releases, which are more than just internet films. These are theatrical-level films. The next one is The Munsters from Rob Zombie, which is coming to theaters and Peacock in September.
I want a man that makes my blood run cold. A man that every time he enters my crypt, it's like a stake through my dead black heart.
I can whip the upper humpy down in the lab.
Oh, no. Remember what happened last time?
He was battered.
I'm looking for a vision. A queen.
True love.
And what exactly do you want?
Is Herman Munster in there?
I like the fact that it's clear Rob Zombie's not going all white trash R-rated with this movie. He's actually making an age-appropriate movie. So kudos to him for that. I give him credit for that. Now, with that said, the guy who plays Grandpa is actually doing a good job in this and delivering the performance he should. The guy who's playing Herman Munster, Fred Gwynn was his own thing, and at least he's not aping Fred Gwynn. He's doing his own cheesy version. Sherry Moon Zombie continues to be the worst of everything that happens in a movie. She's just such a bad actress. And unfortunately, I think you needed a better actress for this movie because it sounds like she's like an anchor character. The biggest problem is the look of the film. It looks like it's something that was shot on video in the 90s. And yeah, maybe he's going for a campy 60s TV show, but that's not what the original TV show was. I mean, it was campy to a degree, but it was basically a standard 60s TV series. It actually had decent production value. I mean, this thing looks like it was decorated with Walmart decorations. It really looks low rent. I just watched the season premiere of What We Do in the Shadows, which has much better production value. Now, it's granted, it's a darker shot series, but it still looks good. Whereas this Munsters movie, it looks like some Goosebumps film that was made in the 90s with a budget of a couple hundred bucks. It's coming to Peacock, so I'll at least watch it there, but I'm not holding out great hope for it. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris and Love Accidentally.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump right into the movie reviews and talk about Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris, or as the original book was, Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris. That was the worst British accent I think ever performed on radio in the history of the world. So you are welcome. You are part of history with that. Leslie Manville stars as a house cleaner from London in the 1950s who uses her widow's pension to travel to Paris to buy a Christian Dior gown.
My Eddie would love to see me in a Dior gown.
War has been over a long time.
Your Eddie's never coming back.
You should have been receiving a war widow's pension. It comes quite a tidy sum.
Oh, it's my Eddie. It's a sign from my angel.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to buy a dress.
A Christian Dior from Paris. Excuse me, dear. I'm after a frock, one of them £500 ones.
You have the wrong dress.
No. Hang on a minute. I've saved every penny scrubbing floors so I can buy this frock.
Of course, obviously, I have to go see this for work, so I brought my mom with me. And, you know, she's the perfect type for this movie. I mean, it's a British movie. It's a little bit stuffy, but it's very, very charming. And even though she didn't really know who Leslie Manville was, she thought she did a great job. And that's true. Leslie Manville completely owns this movie. The movie's not really about, I mean, it is about somebody going to Paris to buy a gown or a frock or whatever, but it's not just about that. It's not just about the trip. It's about a woman fulfilling a dream of hers, as shallow as that dream could be, you know, just to buy a pretty dress, but it means something to her. And the dress is really just a symbol of that last fling in life, you know, the following your dream, doing something that is out of the ordinary. And that's really what the meaning of the dress is. And of course, in the process, she's such a charming, wonderful person that everyone gets on her side and everyone falls in love with her along the way. All the people who she meets at Christian Dior, and she ends up finding her way into the belly of Christian Dior's empire. You know, she just sort of stumbles into it, but it's real sweet. I was surprised at how much I was carried away with this movie. This is like Paddington. You know, if you watch the Paddington movies, he's this fish out of water character that just charms everybody. And that's basically what Mrs. Harris does as well. She just charms everyone and you fall in love with her, and it's absurd and you know it's unrealistic, but it's a fairy tale. And that's kind of what's beautiful about it, is it allows you to sort of take that vicarious throwaway journey with Mrs. Harris and see a beautiful world blossom around you. And it has some negative things that happen in there, but it's not devastating. Too many movies and television, especially television series I've seen, they always have to give you a gut punch. And this one never gives you a gut punch, and that's okay. You know, it's sort of like the show Schitt's Creek. That show is so charming and wonderful and sweet. And part of what makes that show work so well is you never have some sort of devastating catastrophe happen to somebody, because not everything has to be that way. It's like not everyone has to die in a final episode of a season or something like that. And that's the way I felt about Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris. You know, it's lighthearted and sweet. And this movie could charm the pantsuit off of almost anybody. So I'm going to have to say Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris totally rocks. Oh, isn't that charming?
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Love Accidentally. A woman up for a promotion accidentally starts texting with her rival from work, and they unwittingly start a relationship over the phone without knowing exactly who's on the other end.
You wanted to see me?
Great. You're both here.
Both?
How's it going, Parker?
My heart feels like it's been torn out of my chest, thrown on the floor and stomped on, like...
I think you texted the wrong number.
Sorry, new phone.
To be honest, it's happening to me right now, too.
You sent a broken heart text to the wrong person?
You opened up to the stranger?
About your feelings? You could get a name and make sure there's not a podcast about this guy.
This is available on Freevee. If you don't know what Freevee is, it used to be IMDb TV, which is a subset of Amazon. It's basically the free with ads version of Amazon or Prime Video. But Love Accidentally, it stars Brenda Song. She's probably the biggest name in it. Well, no, she's not just the biggest name in there. Denise Richards is in it as well. And can we talk about Denise Richards? I get it. She's like 50, but holy cats. She looks like she was stung in the face by a swarm of bees. she has had so much plastic surgery done on her. And she's only in a couple scenes. She's the boss who kind of gets the ball rolling in this situation. She used to be gorgeous when she was younger. And then, you know, she did her reality TV and you realize what a horrible person she was, you know, with the whole Charlie Sheen stuff. But she's gotten so much work done. It makes you wonder, do LA plastic surgeons say, we could do this procedure and this plumping and this lip thing, or I could just push you down a flight of stairs and that'll make your face look about the same. This is a story we've seen done a billion times before. I mean, it's shop around the corner or you've got mail, that kind of thing. There was with the movie, The Truth About Cats and Dogs with Janine Garofalo. That's another example. I mean, it's been compared to Cyrano de Bergerac, of course, you know, where a different person, they think a different person is talking to you. I remember when I was a kid, I worked in a library and I was in the youth department reading, like, I was just flipping through books that were for young adults. And when there was a romance where there was a wrong number. Pillow Talk's another great example of that with Rock Hudson and Doris Day, where they're on a party line. They don't realize who they're talking to and they fall in love, not realizing that the person in real life they don't like. So it's been done a billion times before and it works as a story. The reality with this movie is it's not for everybody. If you like the simple romances, yeah, you're going to enjoy it. If you're a big fan of the Christmas romances that are on Hallmark TV and everything, yeah, you'll probably enjoy this one. But there's just so many just goofy, weird stuff and stuff in this movie that doesn't even make sense that just jumped out at me. I mean, it's just the story and how it kind of goes about. It's corny and stupid and we've seen it before, but it has these weird moments. Like at one point she says, we need to call ourselves something because they don't want to give names because they're texting back and forth and they want to keep the anonymity. And she goes, what should we call ourselves? Jack and Jill, Bonnie and Clyde, Sonny and Cher. And immediately I'm like, none of those relationships worked out good for anybody involved. I don't know why you're doing it. There's another scene because the whole thing is that they work in sales and they're trying to get like the director of sales job. That's what the rivalry at work is that's happening in real life that they don't realize is happening because they're talking on text. And at one point they're in a winery. They're trying to, one of the big clients are trying to land, owns a winery and the guy doesn't know much about wine. And he says to someone, well, yeah, I could do this because you don't need to drive a Maserati to sell one. And I'm like, yeah, you kind of do. I mean, you do. I mean, if you're going to sell Maserati, you got to be able to, if somebody's going to drop that much money on a Maserati, you should at least be able to know what it's like to drive one. You should at least know how it picks up and how it handles and how it corners and that kind of thing. And if you don't know how to drive it, you're going to come off looking like an idiot in the dealership. And like, there's another line where somebody goes, oh, we're like oil and water. And the guy replies, oh, that kind of combination can start quite a fire. And I'm like, how? It's not sodium in water. I don't know. This movie is just goofy and silly. But, you know, for somebody like my wife who just likes the cutesy pie romance, I mean, the story is overused by a mile and there's an absurd number of plot holes. But this really is made for fans of harmless and mindless romances. And that's okay. You know, it's not for me. I'm going to have to say it sucks. But you might like this if that's the kind of thing you go for.
It sucks.
Next up on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Paws of Fury, The Legend of Hank, and Resident Evil on Netflix. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about some more movies in the theaters. And one of them is Paws of Fury, The Legend of Hank. After an evil land baron chases off a town samurai, he sends a replacement that the people in the village would be sure to hate.
We need a new samurai.
Not it.
Okay, here goes nothing.
What the mother, father, cocker spaniel's going on here?
Sometimes you need a friend.
Sounds like you need help.
Want to see you win.
Hey, this is the training montage, isn't it?
Don't forget to land on your feet.
I have something to tell you. I am your father.
What?
No, I'm not.
I didn't know much about this movie. I knew it was about animals. And it takes place in a world populated, well, with animals, but mostly with cats. takes place in a what I guess the cat version of feudal Japan. So they live in these little Japanese villages with samurai and a shogun who looks over everything. I mean, we've seen animal action movies before. I mean, Kung Fu Panda is another great example, although that's a different country altogether. But in Paws of Fury, the whole idea is they get this dog who they assume all the villagers are going to reject because, well, he's a dog. I was expecting just kind of a cute, goofy action movie for kids. But I'm watching the film, and as it's playing out, you know, they run off this samurai and they send the bandits into town. And the guy who's doing it is sort of this cat overlord. And then he's like, oh, I'll get the one that they're all going to reject, and I'm going to get this dog. And as I'm watching it, I'm like, this story sounds familiar. Because like I said, I didn't know much about this going in. I didn't read about it or anything. And as I'm watching it, I'm like, this is Blazing Saddles. It's absolutely Blazing Saddles. Without all the sex jokes and a lot fewer racial slurs in it. To the point that there are scenes right out of Blazing Saddles, they're just replaying. And then when we finally get to the end of the movie, I saw Richard Pryor and all the writers of Blazing Saddles actually get a screen credit. So yes, Richard Pryor helped write this movie, believe it or not, even though he's been dead for years, because they wrote the original Blazing Saddles. Mel Brooks is involved in this too. He plays the shogun, who is, again, the governor dispensing the samurai to the towns. And as somebody who is such a fan of Blazing Saddles, it's hard to watch at times, not because it's bad, but it's like Blazing Saddles is such a not kids movie. And this one's absolutely a kids movie. I mean, they take out all the dirty jokes and they take out all the inappropriate stuff, but it's a basic story. I mean, it's that epic story of a reluctant hero who the town embraces. Michael Cera plays the black sheriff. I mean, the dog. And you got Samuel L. Jackson playing the Gene Wilder character, who's this ex-samurai who's stuck in jail. They even have a big sumo wrestler who basically is Mongo. It's cute for what it is. I mean, it at times gets a little bit too aware of itself. That's a fine line to walk, especially animation. When the movie Hoodwinked came out and it was in the shadow of Shrek, there was the self-awareness that the movies had, especially in the fairy tale stuff, that pushed a little bit too far into the fourth wall. This one breaks the fourth wall and they make jokes about, oh, are we going into a montage or are we going to have this kind of segment? But they're a little more subtle kind of coming into it. They do explain their jokes too much. The animation's kind of cool, especially there's some actually really neat animation. Reminds me of some of the stuff you saw in the Bad Guys, where the animation is on its surface. You think, oh, it's a very basic animation, but then you start looking at the detail and they do some really neat stuff from an animation perspective. I mean, the kids aren't going to notice it because they're just going to be like, oh, dogs. And there's a whole scene where cats are farting and that's catching on fire. And so, yeah, that does have that low hanging fruit that it goes for. But it does remind me though, like, you know, the big joke, can they remake Blazing Saddles today? Well, apparently they can. If it's about feudal Japanese cats. It's a harmless movie, you know. I mean, once you untangle your brain from the Blazing Saddles influence, it's a punchy, if not predictable, animated action comedy. It's cute. It's worth taking the kids to. So I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Resident Evil. This is a new series on Netflix. After the disasters that faced the Umbrella Corporation, it tries to rebrand and develop a new drug, only to accidentally unleash another apocalypse.
Umbrella, a company besieged by scandal, is now trying to reinvent itself.
We have a problem. The drug contains the T-virus. The T-virus can make monsters.
Billions will die.
Everyone keep your mouth shut.
There are so many iterations of Resident Evil, I can't keep them straight. I've never played the game. I'm really not a gamer. So I've never played any of the Resident Evil games. I've seen most, if not all, of the main theatrical releases. There was that Welcome to Raccoon City version that came out last year that I don't know if anybody saw. And I don't know if this is connected to that or not. But I know the basic gist of it, you know, Umbrella Corporation develops this T-virus and it ends up causing people to turn into zombies. And, you know, in the original film series, the entire world gets wiped out. This one, apparently there's already been an outbreak and they've contained it and Umbrella's trying to sort of rebrand. The big difference between this and the movies themselves, there's actually more plot there. There's a little more story because, you know, it's a series. It's, you know, what, like 8 episodes. I've not seen all 8 episodes. I've seen enough to get a feel of the series. So it does have more of a story because it's told in 2 time frames. It's told in 2022, sort of modern day, where this guy who works at Umbrella brings his daughters with him to this Umbrella facility, New Raccoon City, which I think is in South Africa. And it's the beginning of that outbreak. And then also the parallel story is 16 years in the future or 14 years in the future when the outbreak has happened and one of the daughters is fighting the zombies on her own. Now, when it comes to a series, you can't just have nonstop zombie action. I mean, if anything's proved that, it was The Walking Dead and all of its offshoots because there's almost no action in that TV series. But you have to rely on story. And so there is more content in there. I'm not saying the story's great, but at least it's passable. I mean, at one point I'm watching this and I'm going, well, this is really silly. I mean, there's like the way the outbreak starts, you know, they end up sneaking into the facility and you realize the Umbrella Corporation has been through this before. They know to have better protocols for security. I mean, even to the point where they hack into their dad's account and he's using the same password that he uses for everything. And I'm like, well, that's not even a strong password. The system would make you have a better password at the very least. And the system would probably make you change the password every week or month because it's a corporate giant that doesn't want any of its secrets leaked. So, I mean, there's a bunch of stuff that I go, well, this is really silly or stupid. And then I think back and remember everything else I've ever seen about Resident Evil. All the rest of them just are really heavy on plot and they're equally stupid. So I'm not saying this series is brilliant or even well written, but I don't think it's any worse than a lot of the other Resident Evil stuff that's out there. I have no idea whether it mirrors the game. I can't tell you, but at least I think it's interesting. I was asked by somebody like, well, does it have this anti-corporation thing? And I'm like, well, Resident Evil since the beginning has had an anti-corporation bent to it. The villain in this, I mean, yeah, they're zombies, but the real villain's the Umbrella Corporation. And that's the way it's been since the beginning of Resident Evil, what, 30 years ago. So, yeah, that's nothing new. It's there. It's absolutely there, but that's nothing new. You know, so it's with more of a story woven inside than your average Resident Evil movie, there's more to chew on, but, you know, it falls into the tedium of a modern zombie take. I mean, it does turn into just shooting zombies. There's a little bit more to it, and I appreciate that, but you know, you're still just shooting zombies for a couple hours. So I'm gonna have to say Resident Evil, while I think some people might enjoy it, for me it kinda sucks.
It kinda sucks.
Wait a second, I don't like the sound of that.
Next, when we come back, I'm gonna be talking about Solar Opposite Season 3 and then the Home Cinema Roundup featuring a look back at Electric Dreams. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the reviews and talk about another streaming series, and that is on Hulu, Solar Opposite Season 3. Distancing itself a little bit farther from its own setup, this season finds the aliens breaking the fourth wall, becoming even more meta, and offering a different pace for the people stuck in the wall.
Ah! What's happening?
We just hit a major milestone. Solar Opposites are back for Season 3!
Now that I'm not focusing on the mission or fixing the ship, I'm free to do whatever I want.
Oh, I've been waiting for this day.
Yeah! Sounds like the Solar Opposites are going to be having some fun this year.
I'm so
supposed to be taking care of the pupa?
He does love him some wacky hijinks.
You've been shrinking people and putting them in a wall?
Oh, that rules! Makes me want to do...
Don't you segue into a montage.
A montage! We're going to Hulu Land!
First of all, that setup that I gave makes no sense if you don't know anything about Solar Opposites. This is the third season. It's on Hulu exclusively. And first of all, you got to understand, if you've not watched Solar Opposites, it's created by some of the people who do the Rick and Morty series, to the point that the animation looks very similar. And it's not exactly like Rick and Morty, but it does have that science fiction angle to it. It has that headiness, that creating new worlds. It's not as out there as Rick and Morty, weirdly enough, because this one's actually about aliens. I mean, it has that self-referential thing, and it does kind of go to weird places, but it doesn't seem as drug-fueled as Rick and Morty does. I mean, Rick and Morty, just watch the opening sequence of Rick and Morty, and you'll be like, this thing's messed up. Solar Opposites plays a little bit more like a Family Guy episode. It's not done by the people who do Family Guy, but it has that idea where it's this suburban house. And it's just, but these aliens are involved. But the aliens are horrible. Not people. These are not people. But they're horrible entities. They're very self-serving. And the whole purpose is they're supposed to repopulate the planet, but they get stuck on Earth and they never get around to doing what they're supposed to do. And you have these side stories on some of these adult animation things. They have this whole section where the younger aliens have shrunk people down and put them in a wall, like a giant terrarium. And I know a lot of people love that diversion. They love the story of the people stuck in the wall because they have to sort of form their own government and they have to, and they're in fighting and there's different classes and strata in there. And it's a real, you know, it's its own, you could have your own series about the people in the wall. I'm not a huge fan of the wall stories, but where this one I think works is they managed to tell both stories throughout. You know, it used to be, if I recall, they'd have like one episode just about the people in the wall, and then they'd go back to the Solar Opposites for the rest. But they kind of tell these concurrent stories, so it's not like if you don't like the wall, you just have to get through those parts and you still got a Solar Opposites episode. You don't feel like you're bouncing back and forth between stories. But they are way more meta in this one. They've always been meta, and the Rick and Morty stuff does get very meta. And similarly with this, or even like the Family Guy stuff, it's very aware that it's a TV show and they're referencing it and they're joking about Hulu. There's a whole episode where they go to Hulu Land and you have rides based on all the different Hulu stores. And there's a lot of Disney jokes because of course now Disney owns 20th Century Studios, which produces this show and they have an ownership stake in Hulu. So there's an awareness to it. And I think that that's fine because I think that allows the show to evolve because we're no longer just watching them messing crap up with a sci-fi concept. And I appreciate that. So I had a lot of fun watching this season. I'm a big fan of Solar Opposites. I think it's a little more stable of a series than Rick and Morty because Rick and Morty is so out there, but it does kind of fit that family sitcom, adult animation, science fiction setup. And for me, that works. So I'm going to have to say I enjoyed Solar Opposites season 3. To me, it fits nicely in line with the other two, even though the season settles into its own fandom a little too much. But it sells plenty of surprises to shake up the narrative. So I'm going to say it rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on an 80s movie, and there's a reason why I'm covering it. The movie is Electric Dreams, which came out in 1984. It was an original film that starred Letty Van Dolen, and the reason I'm covering it is because Van Dolen died just recently. He died, I think, on the 5th of July. He had been sick for a while. It's not that a whole lot of people don't remember him. It's that he didn't have a huge career, but he had these peaks, no pun intended, because he was on the series Twin Peaks. He played a role in that. He's best known for Electric Dreams, but he showed up in a bunch of different things. Like, there's an episode of Red Dwarf that he's in. So he's shown up in a bunch of stuff and he's steadily worked over the years, but these are the kind of things he's best known for. Since he passed away, I decided to go back and watch Electric Dreams. And in that film, a timid architect buys a computer that gains sentience and interferes with his personal life.
What's your preference? Apple, Pear, Wang?
Oh, listen, I don't know anything about computers.
Nobody does.
Miles just bought a computer, and he got more than he bargained for.
You're talking.
You'll notice.
Madeline just moved in upstairs, and she's the girl he's falling for.
But I don't know what love is. You never told me.
When Edgar comes between them,
I want to meet her.
Things start to get electric.
You're taking over my life!
I saw Electric Dreams in the theatrical run back in 1984, and I remember I was just maybe a little too young for it, but I found myself fascinated with it. There's elements of this that just galvanized itself as a movie from the 80s, and it's kind of forgotten by a lot of people. You can find it on Tubi, and I think it's on the Roku channel for free and on Philo or something like that, but it's out there. It used to be hard to get. There was a laser disc out there, and I actually found a copy of it on YouTube probably about 5 or 6 years ago. But since then, they've released it on DVD and Blu-ray again. And part of it is it was made at the height of music videos, and it was directed by Steve Barron, who was eventually went on to do stuff like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie. But he was best known for doing music videos as a director of music videos. And it has a real music video feel to it. If you watch the movie, it feels like a 90-minute music video. But it does galvanize that feeling of the 80s, because by the time 84 rolled around, the architecture and the pop culture and the styles and the color schemes had fully merged into giving what you would see as the mid-80s. It's the story of this sort of lonely architect who he builds this computer system and gains sentience, and the girl who lives upstairs, played by Virginia Madsen in one of her earliest roles, he kind of falls in love with her. Now, it's a simple story, and she is sort of the prize, and she doesn't get the depth, but she gets surprisingly more depth in this than your standard 80s female gaze romance that you would get back in the mid-decade there. And she's actually really charming, and she's very sweet, and they make her a little more real, but she still is that prize, which is typical of an 80s movie. And it has some great music to it. It has some songs. I remember it was promoted as having new songs from Culture Club at the time, but it used other artists at the time. And the music soundtrack itself was sort of the synth soundtrack. And I have to say, I get drawn to this movie every 5 to 10 years. I seek it out and I watch it. And I recognize it's not a great movie. It has real problems with the story and some of the characters, and the pacing's weird, but there's something that connects to me about it. There's something about the computer, the Edgar, the computer, who's voiced by Bud Cort, who was not allowed in the normal set when he was doing it because they wanted him as a sort of like off-screen voice. And he doesn't get a whole lot of depth to that character, but there's something there. There's something quintessentially charming in the 80s that draws me back to this film. And I found that it's not my favorite movie from that decade or ever, but I really love it. I mean, it's an unabashed benchmark of 80s music video cinema. And it tells a sweet, if not one-sided, love story and features a fantastic soundtrack. I mean, it's what you want from an 80s movie that still feels like it can connect outside of its time. So I'm going to have to say Electric Dreams, even though it's not the best movie, I have a real soft spot for it. I'm going to say it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Also available on home cinema this week, we've got new on disc, Lower Decks Season 2 and Killing Eve Season 6. New on VOD, the Bob's Burgers movie is available on Hulu and HBO Max, along with Brian and Charles on VOD. And then AMC Plus has the return of Better Call Saul. And Disney Plus has the final episode of Ms. Marvel. And that's it. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Jordan Peele's film Nope. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.